This is Sophia.
And I'm Victoria.
You're listening to It's All History to Me, Auburn's History Radio Hour at 8 a.m. on Thursdays. Each week, we will interview a history professional with the theme of bridging the past and present.
Let's get started.
I am in a conventional dither with a conventional star in my eye. And you will note there's a lump in my throat.
Hello, and welcome back to It's All History to Me. This morning we are joined by Dr. David Carter, an associate professor of history at Auburn University. Dr. Carter received his bachelor's degree at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and then went on to receive his PhD at Duke University. Dr. Carter's research and teaching are in the history of Black freedom struggle, the history of the American South since the Civil War, the history of racial terror lynching, race riots, and other forms of racialized violence in the U.S. history since 1945. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Dr. Carter.
Thank you all, both. Appreciate it.
What got you interested in studying history?
That is always a question I start just thinking about being around the dinner table. My father was a practicing historian at Emory University for most of his career, and so I think I grew up sort of not realizing that I was being subjected to history lectures every night at dinner. And I don't think I ever thought about it as a profession until high school. I had this amazing history teacher named Robert Morgan, who sadly passed away a few years back, but he just electrified generations of students at this neat public school, Druid Hills High School in Atlanta. And so I think it was seeing a teacher in action. And I think his approach was a little closer to a college professor. So kind of caught the bug there. And my father certainly never pushed me to do it. In fact, I think he would have said, you know, be a dentist or something. it was exposure to great teaching in high school, I think.
That's awesome. Okay. As we mentioned in your introduction, much of your research and teaching focuses on the Black freedom struggle in the United States. How did you decide to make this your historical focus?
That's a great question. I think when I was in undergrad days like you all, I knew I wanted to study some aspect of race relations and probably in the American South, but I was more focused on the late 19th century and the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. Again, mainly just which professors you work with, who you bring the material to life. But then when it came time to apply to graduate school, I had written a thesis on the late 1800s, and I was having to pick programs based on what professors were there, and wound up sort of casting the lot with the 20th century focus at Duke University. Mm-hmm. So, and I think, again, it was just suddenly the civil rights era felt more accessible, the idea that you could actually talk to participants who had been part of the struggle, all of that made it compelling. I know if any of my colleagues who do medieval history or ancient history are listening, they're like, you don't have to have people alive to make it interesting. But for me, it was kind of an easier entry point.
That makes sense.
Yeah. What do you consider to be the civil rights movement?
That is a great struggle and a great question, because I think for years we used this terminology of the civil rights movement. And then those of us who study it talk about sort of good movement, bad movement. And for a lot of people, they were, over time, we should always acknowledge at the time, there were so many people fiercely opposed to the civil rights movement. But once you move into the 70s and particularly the 80s, there's this sort of retroactive embrace of, oh, sure, the walls had to come tumbling down and we had to get the segregation signs down. But there was another part of the Black freedom struggle that was maybe Malcolm X or a gentleman named Robert Williams who was saying that Blacks should have the right to defend themselves, or Angela Davis and the Black Power movement, the Black Panther Party for self-defense. And I think a lot of some scholars, but especially the sort of general public, and particularly white people, were made uncomfortable by that aspect of the Black activist spectrum. And so they would sort of say, we were down with Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. and maybe even Fannie Lou Hamer, but when it comes to Malcolm X or H.R.A.P. Brown or Eldridge Cleaver, the Black Panthers, that makes us more uneasy. So we tended to focus and teach, I think, to young people just this one side of the struggle that focused on nonviolent direct action. And then over time, I think it helped to have activists themselves entered academia, and they just said, look, you're missing the bigger picture here. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a reconceptualization. The idea of a black freedom struggle encompasses all of the civil rights movement and then also this broader thing. And I think that the other quick thing I would say is that civil rights are so important and voting rights, but the black freedom struggle brings under the banner economic justice, mm-hmm. and questions about how power and resources are distributed in a society. And that's that gets to be sort of a third rail issue sometimes, where people are more comfortable talking about access to public accommodations, but when you suddenly start asking questions about haves and have-nots economically, that's the point I usually tell students. When Dr. King shifts his focus from civil rights and voting rights to economic justice, mm-hmm. some of the last activism, and he comes out against the Vietnam War, his popularity just plummets. So there's almost right. like a good Dr. King, bad Dr. King, and the mm-hmm. one that we commemorate every year is the one that more people are comfortable with.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. And neat to hear you talk about like how multifaceted it is and that there's so many different elements.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite element of the movement or the genre in general of this time period that you especially enjoy teaching or writing or learning about?
Yeah, I think for me, and I'm kind of old school because I still think that presidents matter and giant great women and great men leaders matter within a social movement interacting with the government. But I also think odds are young people have been maybe exposed a little bit to some of those variables. And so for me, what's really fun is introducing characters who, if it were a Broadway musical, right, they'd be listed on page 2 if they're listed at all. And often those people's stories are sort of fresher, and there's great documentary film footage that you can show. There's a clip I always show of a mother whose son gets arrested in a sit-in, and she's weeping talking about it but also laughing because she says her son calls her from the jail and he's like, Mom, be cool, you know, it's gonna be okay, be cool. And it's this woman in the early 60s and she's like, he told me to be cool. And I think students, some they can just empathize more with people who are really them. I always tell the students, like, this was you 64 years ago. You all were the ones who were asking the important questions. And to me, that makes it more accessible, where if we're talking about senators and presidents, you know, maybe you all wind up in the White House, but odds are most of us don't reach that apex of power. But if you can show people aspects of history where everyday women and men really do become agents of historical change, to me that's a good way to have us all think about how can we enter the historical narrative, maybe not in profound ways, but just little ways we might move the needle.
Yeah, definitely.
You've already spoken about this a little bit, but are there any misconceptions or misinformation about the civil rights movement that's commonly accepted that you would like to dispel?
Oh, that's a great question. Let me process that for a moment, because if I go on a rant, I think some of us get very agitated about the amount of misinformation I think that's out there. One might be, I think, the way in which some of these groups that are framed as more militant or radical, even those labels, I think, sort of instantly get our hackles up. So I mentioned an activist named Robert Williams, and he founded a National Rifle Association chapter in North Carolina in the 1950s, and basically just said that black people ought to have the right to defend themselves if they were attacked. And it's sort of in this lineage. There was a famous Harlem Renaissance poet, Claude McKay, who argued that if lynch mobs came after blacks, that blacks should have the right to defend themselves. And in a culture where we often venerate the right to bear arms, I think it's sometimes people who accept that unquestionably suddenly get very uneasy with the right of marginalized groups to maybe bear arms or defend themselves. And so I think for me, seeing people who were really just putting out the idea that our lives are worth protecting, even if personally, I think a proponent of nonviolence. I also feel like in a culture that's so mired in violence, people who are just saying we want to be able to protect our families, that we shouldn't label them necessarily as militant or radical, because there's a lot of Americans who believe that they ought to have the right to do that. So that's one example. I think another is sort of this great man theory of history, and the more I learn about Martin Luther King Jr., the more fascinated I am, but our tendency to boil things down to where we just look at a handful of big activists. So much of the civil rights struggle and the larger black freedom struggle are about everyday people not only pushing people in positions of federal authority or state authority to act, but even having to push people like Dr. King. When the students launched the sit-ins in 1960, initially Dr. King and his organization are very much sort of opposed. We didn't authorize this. How can we control this? And the students say, look, it's our movement now. You have to respond to us. So I think that's still a tendency we have to assume everything's orchestrated from the top, when in fact a lot of neat things are bubbling up from below.
Yeah, good points. Okay, having become a mainstay of the history department here at Auburn University, do you have a special memory from your teaching career at Auburn that you would like to share?
I do. Let me do this very delicately. So I have a lot of wonderful, wonderful memories. And it's always great to see students sort of emerge years later. And during the aftermath of the tragic George Floyd killing, I had several students who reached out and said, I see the sort of larger context of police community relations and police brutality in a different light because of this longer historical spectrum and chronology that you introduced me to. But another story I would tell is a little more awkward, and that was a student who years and years ago was very interested in Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, who was this wonderful sharecropper activist from Ruleville, Mississippi. And she, classic agitator, would speak truth to power. President Johnson really didn't like her because she would speak truth. And her class position marginalized her. She lost her place as a sharecropper as soon as she tried to seek the right to vote. But I had a student who was fascinated with her civil rights activism and wanted to write a paper. And I said, oh, that'd be great. You'll really be And then the student came back 2 days later and said, I can't write about this activist. And I said, why not? And they said, I found out they're a feminist. So that was a kind of moment where I realized that maybe we wrap our minds around civil rights as a sort of acceptable position of challenging authority. But for this person, at least, feminism was a bad word. Mm. And so when I teach the movement, I try to suggest there are all these interlocking strands that even within the movement, often women are being marginalized, so they start to ask questions, and sometimes men say one struggle at a time, and women say, why should that be? Why can't we work on different sides of oppression at the same time?
Right.
For our last question of this section, how would you say that your work ties into our theme this semester of bridging the past and present?
Yeah, you all's theme is great when you contacted me, because that's that question that I think a lot of historians, when we stand up there on day one of world history, is, you know, why does this matter? You're checking the box for the core curriculum, a lot of them. but if you can convince people that understanding the past even a little better can help you see the current landscape. So in my world history teaching this semester, I'm sure my students, if I say Russia one more time, they're going to just all walk out en masse. But I keep focusing on the Ukraine conflict and trying to help them see how knowing more about Russia's historical sensibility going back even before the Napoleonic invasion helps frame what I see as a just terrible tragedy where one leader, Putin, and other Russians who have this sort of mythical notion of what Russia is are completely trying to erase a valid nationality and ethnicity. So so I think understanding the past of that part of Europe can help people better appreciate the stakes in the Ukrainian conflict, for example.
Yeah, definitely. So many important things going on in the world right now that can be bridged from the past.
We're going to take an ad break, but we'll see you in 2 minutes.
Good morning, and welcome back to It's All History to Me. This morning, we're joined by Dr. Carter, and now we're going to move into a conversation about his first book, The Music Has Gone Out of the Movement, Civil Rights and the Johnson Administration, from 1965 to 1968, which was published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2009. The book depicts the relationship between President Lyndon Johnson and grassroots activists, particularly after the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. So what was the inspiration for your book?
That's a great question. So a lot of historians' first books emerge from their dissertations, not all of them, but it starts with finishing your coursework as a graduate student, passing preliminary exams, and then you sort of feel like, I've made it through this huge hurdle, and then your professor sits you down and they say, you know, really a PhD is about writing a dissertation. And I'm not one of those historians who has 20 projects on the back burner. I admire my colleagues who are just like, oh, I've got 30 topics. For me, I love it when a colleague will say, oh, you should do this. And as soon as I get onto a project, I really like sinking my teeth into it. Yeah. But I have to be honest that a couple of my mentors said, have you thought about how the Black freedom struggle, we spend so much time on that period from, say, the Brown school desegregation decision and Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, follow that through the next decade to the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and then it's like the historiography, the books that are written about the movement just go off a cliff. Mm-hmm. There, at that point, and this was the early 1990s, there really wasn't much literature about what happens after you get a Civil Rights Act and a Voting Rights Act. It was almost like we jumped from this lily pad of the mid-1960s to Dr. King's death in 1968. Mm. And so one of my mentors, a great historian named Stephen Lawson, he had this question. He said, what happens to a social movement once it reaches the seat of power? So when suddenly it becomes a little more acceptable and the government's paying attention. And some movement activists at the time called it a crisis of victory. They're like, we've achieved so many of these big goals that we wanted. What do you do next? Mm. And so that drew me to looking at those 3 years, the last 3 years of Johnson's presidency, when I think the clarity around what Black activists were seeking, they knew what they were looking for, but I think the nation at large became increasingly ambivalent. They sort of said, you're asking for too much, you're moving too fast. And truthfully, if you go backwards, that had been the response of the nation over and over again, too fast, too much. But particularly in 1965, I think with a lot of Black activists asking questions about economics, and with the Vietnam War really heating up, the fiscal puzzle changes where suddenly there aren't as many billions of dollars to invest in domestic reform. So it led me to just ask, what is that relationship like between different parts of the civil rights movement and Johnson? And it turned out to be a really interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What is the meaning behind the book's title, The Music Has Gone Out of the Movement?
So that was by a journalist who was writing for a Washington paper that no longer exists, but she, in the middle of this period where more and more activists are feeling alienated from the federal government, they're dealing with violence and feeling like the government's not paying attention. And I talk about it with students as the big six. There were six civil rights leaders that often from the Kennedy administration forward, whenever a president wanted to sort of take the pulse of Black America, which is kind of ridiculous given how many millions of Black Americans there were, the idea was if we bring these six men into the Oval Office representing six different organizations, we'll know what Black Americans are thinking. And during that period that I was writing about, it was almost like spelling bee bubbles on a Peanuts cartoon. Just the big six became the big five and the big four and the big three because a certain Black activist criticized the administration or came out against the Vietnam War. Lyndon Johnson would just say, you're now persona non grata. We're not going to invite you to the White House. So I think the sense that many people had that the civil rights movement activists were all on the same page and sort of singing in the same key during that period you see infighting within parts of the Black freedom struggle that becomes more visible. I would argue that it was always there. There were always differences about strategy and tactics, but it bubbles over into public view. And so this journalist sort of observing that, I think so many people associate music with the civil rights struggle and beautiful people singing in unison and calling out freedom songs in mass meetings and churches. And suddenly it was either the music didn't sound the same or maybe that music had just disappeared. And so her verdict was sort of the music has gone out of the movement. But some people who read the book would say, I liked your book, but I hated your title.
Oh, no.
'Cause they would say it's too depressing you know, 'cause I was really actually trying to argue that the music is still there, but it has gotten more cacophonous and dissonant, like really good jazz where it might not sound great to everybody, but interesting things are happening.
Right.
So, but some people, again, thought I was suggesting too much of a tragic narrative for the period.
And interesting how all of that comes to light as it intersects with those big people in power.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, what were the grassroots activists hoping to gain in their relationship with the president?
I think first and foremost access, because for so many of them, they felt like the only way they could capture the eyes and ears of the White House was through, again, a handful of leaders. And so someone like Mrs. Hamer sort of forces the White House to pay attention to what's happening and what the day-to-day concerns are of sharecroppers, because a lot of these activists, they're hugely important, but they tend to be middle-class backgrounds and more educated. And so some of the grassroots activists said those people aren't always on top of all our concerns. An example might be after the Montgomery bus boycott sort of won and blacks were allowed on the buses in Montgomery, Dr. King had this idea, okay, our next target should be the airport in Montgomery. And on the one hand, yes, it was segregated, and that was certainly something that needed to be dismantled. But I think his tone deafness there was the fact that most black Montgomeryans weren't flying at that point. And so it revealed a class difference in the movement where it would have been better to pick a target that affected the lives of – that affected Dr. King personally, because he was flying quite a bit by that point. But so there's some class cleavages in the movement. And the activists, I think, that I was most interested in were the ones who were saying the vote is important and civil rights, access to hotels. But what Ella Baker, this magnificent leader, famously said, this is bigger than a hamburger or more than a hamburger. And sitting in at a lunch counter, gaining the right to be served is important, but what if you can't afford the hamburger?
Right.
And a lot of these activists are again, talking about sort of the next stage in the struggle for civil rights. And it should have resonated with Johnson, because he had come from more modest beginnings and was committed to this vision he had of a war on poverty.
Right.
But I think with Johnson, his ego gets in the way so much that he feels like they're failing to appreciate his leadership. When the Watts riot, for example, breaks out in 1965 in South Central Los Angeles, he says, how could they do this to me after I've given them so much? And that reflected a really myopic view of black people in South Central Los Angeles. They could already vote. They could already go places, but they had sort of no one to vote for and no real place to go. They're trapped in very hard scrabble circumstances. But it shows Lyndon Johnson sort of flattening out black Americans and feeling like people in L.A. should be grateful for maybe voting rights in Alabama. So that was, I think my book looks at this grudging broadening on the part of the federal government. Oh, we really have to pay attention to people in the inner city neighborhoods. But it's a halting process. And I don't think Lyndon Johnson gets there. What I was trying to show was that some white bureaucrats and some black activists and who had gone into the government, they really start to broaden their cast of characters. And to me, that was important, even if Johnson was dropping the ball left and right. I thought the government's bigger than just one president.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
What are the sources that guided your research and writing?
I think I was lucky because since I was interested in the White House, one of the things that White Houses are great at doing is just generating insane amounts of records, and it becomes a sort of needle in the haystack. After Nixon and Watergate, the presidents are more hesitant to record their conversations because they find out it can come back to bite them. But in the Johnson period, they're a lot of things really do get put down on paper that show how people are really feeling. And sometimes Johnson will scribble these just sometimes terrible and fascinating things, just a couple words that really reveal his state of mind. Mm-hmm. So on the federal side of things, I felt like I had rich sources. And then the challenge was, how can I really get into what the activist landscape is looking like? And the best way to do that, and the way, if I had to do it all over again, I would do a lot more, is to go out and interview people. So I did some of that, but some of my book referees who have a chance to look at your work before it publishes, they said, we know you've got to get this book out, but you know, try to do as many interviews. And the ones that I did were just really extraordinary of what you can gain when you're able to ask the questions, because there's a lot of oral histories conducted by others, but until you get to sort of ask the questions you want to know the answers to, it really led me to think, okay, if I ever do a project again about people who are still alive, I have to do a lot more oral history.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And ties back into how we started the conversation about your topic of focus as well, and how that is so powerful that there's still people that can talk to it.
Yeah. And I would just throw in there, it's one of the great sadnesses, is I feel like every 2 weeks or so I read an obituary of, and I'm like, oh, Charles McDough. And it's a little bit more personal. My father, I'm tremendously proud of the fact that as a very young white guy from a small town in South Carolina, he started working for a newspaper, and this editor somehow kind of opened up his universe a little bit. And so as a student, he would say he wasn't involved in the movement, but he was. And he got to meet people like former Congressman John Lewis and Ella Baker, and once woke up at a retreat center for blacks and whites coming together, and there was Dr. King sitting on a bed next to him.
Wow.
Polishing his shoes. So for me, I've gotten to know some activists that I might not have known were it not for my parents' generation. So that's been a real blessing, but also it hit hard when you have these people you respect so much who are just passing from the scene. Because most, outside from the youngest activists, people are now in their 80s and 90s and older.
Wow, yeah. What do you hope readers will take away from your book?
That's a great question. The dark secret that I'm going to tell you all, and you all can shatter this with your own works, is that a lot of books don't go widely read. So I feel like the way I reach most people with my book is to sort of teach the themes of it to, over time, hundreds of students in classes. But I think the word I always choose is messy. And some students don't like messy, but I try to say history is messy. And this view that we've imposed on the 1960s of a sort of arc of progress, maybe up through 1965, and then I call it a tragic narrative where with the Watts riot and urban rioting, the escalation in Vietnam, it's like everything seems to be falling apart. And then with the tragic assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy in 1968, it does feel in some ways like things are falling apart. But my hope was with the book to say, just because there are these tragic exclamation points in this period, there are these signs of what could be or what might have been, and it's important to recognize the efforts of those who, they might not have succeeded, but they were trying to sort of, what Dr. King referred to as bending the moral arc of the universe. And again, they didn't bend it very much, but the fact that they were trying to and thought that was important, to me, it's important to bring that to a larger audience.
Absolutely.
We're going to take an ad break, but we'll see you in 2 minutes. Hello, and welcome back to It's All History to Me. This morning we are joined by Dr. Carter from the Auburn University History Department. In addition to his teaching and his own research, Dr. Carter also served as the co-editor of Mississippi Burning and the Passage of the Civil Rights Act, published by W.W. Norton & Company in 2011. What inspired this project?
This was really pure serendipity. Lucky connections through my father. He was at a conference and bumped into a young historian named Kent B. Germany. And he told me that Dr. Germany was working at the Miller Center, which is a sort of humanities think tank at the University of Virginia. And he knew that Dr. Germany and I were both interested in LBJ. And so I met Dr. Germany and found out he was part of a team of documentary editors who were working with hundreds and hundreds of hours of recordings that were secretly made in the White House, not only during the Johnson administration, but going all the way back to Franklin Roosevelt. And I knew, and I'm sure you all did too, famously about, or infamously, the Nixon presidential recordings.
Right.
And so when the Watergate crisis and scandal broke, it not only let us know that Nixon was recording, but I think people started saying, has this been done before? And sure enough, while people didn't record quite as much as Nixon, there were, I think, 800 hours of LBJ era recordings.
Wow.
And I think the presidents, again, it speaks to their, I guess one has to have a huge ego to wind up in the White House, but they they saw it as a way to shape their historical memory. Mm-hmm. I think many of them thought, oh, I can go back and listen to these when I'm writing my memoirs. And we found out the hard way that it also could become the sort of smoking gun if you recorded evidence of corruption in the case of Nixon. But it does give you a sort of fascinating immediacy where a presidential memoir, they're going to massage things in a way that favors them, I think. But to hear these historical conversations with one of the most powerful people in the world is really interesting. Mm-hmm. So I just lucked into this backdoor connection to Dr. Germany and some of his fellow residents there at the Miller Center, and I'd be lying if I said that I got to get as immersed in the details of the project as they were, because they were there 24/7, and I would sort of fly in for a weekend. But it's a neat project they've got going.
Yeah, that's really, really neat. What decisions went into editing a volume like this of so many hours of footage?
Yeah, that's the challenge, because you get, as I've just done there with like a you're looking at all this, listening to all these hours, and people, when they forget that they're being recorded, they're not always their best selves, which is good. It means the recordings are often authentic.
Mm-hmm.
But when LBJ recordings started to be made public, people really were entertained by them. There's a famous one where he calls up the president of a men's clothing company called Hagar. I don't know how it's pronounced, but he just starts describing how he wants his pants to fit in very specific and awkward ways that are best not addressed on the radio. But you're like, really? You know, and actually at that point he was an ex-president, but it was still, this is the former president of the United States. I want to talk about how my pants fit. And then, you know, another day it'll be he's talking to the premier of Russia, or in this case, with the volume we were doing, this tragedy of Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner and James Chaney were three young civil rights activists who were brutally murdered in the summer of 1964. And everybody at the time, I say everybody, there were some Southern whites who said it was a scam, and some people said that the three young men had gone to Cuba and were sort of staging their deaths. But if you listen to LBJ talking with the FBI, say J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, or talking to senators from Mississippi, there's this sort of brutal reality where you can just hear in LBJ's voice, he says, look, I think the kids are dead. And it's a lot of historians are drawn to this moment because two of the activists, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, are white. James Chaney was from the area near Meridian, Mississippi, and was a black man. And a lot of us who study this period argue that if all three victims had maybe been men of color or activists of color, would we have paid the same amount of attention. The fact that it was two well-connected white young people sort of brought the tragedy to a national level of attention. And it also caused some cleavages within the struggle where black activists were asking questions like, does my life matter less if I'm not tied into larger networks of power and privilege? But for Johnson, you see, you see him wrestling with how to massage the optics of the case, how to make it look like the federal government is acting. And it is actually a pivotal moment where the FBI before 1964 is really in many ways an adversary to the black freedom struggle. They claim they have to maintain these relationships with local law enforcement, and that's certainly true. But it meant, in many cases, they were actively working against the civil rights struggle. And with the murders of these three activists, Johnson, I think, should deserve some credit for pushing J. Edgar Hoover, who was a staunch opponent of many civil rights activities, to say, you know, look, Director, when it comes to people being murdered, you know, you're going to have to bring the FBI to bear. And so for the first time in 1964, the FBI really starts playing a bigger role in the civil rights landscape in a sometimes constructive way. I would say overwhelmingly over time, the role of the FBI remained negative. But it's again, I think, an important moment. And I think for Americans at large, they had seen the assassination of Medgar Evers or attacks on student sit-ins, but the sort of callousness of this, just that you could make three people disappear in the middle of the night, it led some people who might have been on the fence about the struggle to say, you know, I was okay with this and this. And that's even more true the following year when those four little girls are killed in the church in Birmingham. I think people say, I was willing to look the other way, but when they're blowing up children in churches, I just can't remain on the sidelines. So some people would say I should be more cynical about that, but I actually believe that people are transformed sometimes by exposure to these tragic acts of violence.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is the main takeaway you gain from being a part of this project?
I think, again, it comes back to that sort of messiness. We have this idea that presidents, or maybe we don't, but I think growing up, I was like, oh, they must be laser beam focused on the issue of the day. And when you read about, say, John F. Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis or LBJ during a key moment in Vietnam, what historians are focusing on is what they were doing in that moment. And then if you look at the presidential daily diary or you listen to these recordings, you realize that, you know, this 15 minutes of the day, they were doing that. But the next 15 minutes, part of my book looks at a famous speech Johnson gave, and I focused a whole chapter on it. But I became aware that that was really a tiny part of his attention that month. What he was really focused on was a foreign policy crisis in the Dominican Republic. And so for me, listening to the recordings, you get the sense of how presidents aren't setting the agenda. The agenda is being set by reality, and presidents are just scrambling to react. And just about every president, maybe with one exception recently, I feel like has come out of the White House saying, that was what surprised me. I sort of thought I'd be able to call the shots, and instead it was this mad scramble to deal with this crisis and put that fire out. So I think the White House tends to, if you look at someone like Jimmy Carter, who looked pretty young in 1977 when he was sworn in, and he comes out in 1981 when Reagan's sworn in, and he just looks like he's aged 20 years in 4 years. So listening to the recordings, I'm struck by just the gravity of the circumstances they face and the fact that they're really not in control of nearly as much as we'd like to imagine.
Yeah, that's definitely a powerful message and a good takeaway. How do you envision this publication being used now that it has been published?
Well, I think in all honesty, it won't be used at all in the form. I tried to find a way to buy a copy of it recently and found it's hard to find in print. But the great thing is all the work that these magnificent folks have done at the University of Virginia. And I want to give a shout out to students because a lot of when you listen to these transcripts, the audio quality is surprisingly terrible.
Oh, no.
You would think like it's the president of the United States. They'll have super hi-fi equipment. But there are these clicking sounds. It's a reel-to-reel recording system. And just as with some of your guests on the radio show, sometimes people aren't you know, thinking about where's the microphone hidden in the room. And so it's really painstaking to try to reconstruct the transcript. And the first wave of that is always done by students at the University of Virginia, including undergrads. And so they'll scrub through the audio and get as much as they can. And now we have some software tools that can help isolate certain frequencies, cut down on ambient noise. Mm-hmm. But it's still a lot of human hours involved. And then, so that's a long-winded way of saying the great thing about the project is now those digital sources are increasingly available both through public websites and then through paywalled things where researchers can search through that data in a much more efficient way than they could with a book. So things are keyworded and metadata that some of my public history colleagues would be able to understand better than me. For me, the main thing is accessibility. Could a high school student who wants to know more about the Vietnam War, they could now listen to someone like Eisenhower or Kennedy or LBJ talking about Vietnam, hear just how, again, the sense of powerlessness in some ways that they felt over circumstances. So even though the book won't be seen by that many eyes, I feel like the work that Dr. Germany and a little bit me and all those wonderful students and colleagues there did helps to make presidential history more accessible to a larger group of people.
Yeah. We're going to take an ad break, but we'll see you in 2 minutes. Welcome back to It's All History to Me. We're joined this morning by Dr. Carter, and we're about to reach our last section of trivia questions and our final questions. Are you ready for this trivia?
I'm not remotely ready. And this is very distressing because I'm having flashbacks. The history department used to have a trivia contest every year. And once I was asked what year the Berkeley free speech movement took place in, and it was sort of a mainstay of my teaching, do not ask me what year it was. And I just froze in the headlights. And some of my graduate students have, you know, 20 years later, they're like, oh, yeah, Dr. Carter, tell us about the Berkeley free speech movement. So I hope that's not one of your trivia questions.
I don't think it is. I think you're safe.
Okay, great.
Our first question is, who took steps to petition the United Nations Commission for Human Rights to investigate charges that the United States was violating not just the civil rights, but also the human rights of African Americans?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes. All right, I'm going to get it wrong, but I'm going to say James Baldwin, but it's going to be wrong.
The answer we had was Malcolm X.
Yes, that is exactly right. And that is appalling that Dr. Carter. So, yes, that's great. I'll try to cover myself by saying that Baldwin was involved in that dialogue. But, yes, Malcolm X famously, I think there's a report that goes to that commission that says we charge genocide. And the mm-hmm. terminology of genocide is obviously very loaded. But it was an example of Black Americans trying to say we should view this in an international human rights context. Okay, 0 for 1. Let's go.
Okay, our second question. During the 1960s, a free breakfast program for children in Oakland, California was sponsored by?
And this is something I always tell my students is that if possible, even though it's a mouthful, one should say the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Often we say just the Panthers or the Black Panther Party, but I always like to remind people that self-defense part, people get sometimes alarmed by the Panthers. They were carrying weapons. They seemed, quote, militant or radical. But their rhetoric was grounded in this idea, again, that Black people were vulnerable and ought to be able to defend themselves. So I think that's the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly what we have.
Great.
All right. For our second to last question of the hour, why is it important that we study history?
Okay, great question. To keep people like me, I think I was talking with you all a little bit during one of the breaks. I think sometimes history feels irrelevant to a lot of people. It's sort of this musty rummaging around in archives, and how could that possibly be relevant to the contemporary landscape? And for me, it's everywhere we turn, I tell students stories about this tragic conflict in the Balkans, in places like Sarajevo. And when I was growing up, that was all Yugoslavia, and my parents visited Yugoslavia. And then within a matter of years of their visit, bridges that had been there for 800 years were being blown up in the Balkan civil wars. And a colleague I worked with at Duke University in their graduate program, he said, David, that the tragedy of this is that for the first time my students know where Sarajevo is, or they've heard of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And he said, I'm glad that they now know, but the contemporary events were sort of bringing to light the past. Mm-hmm. And whether it's Ukraine or the tragedy right now in the Middle East, I think having that long view of history can really shape our ability to try to empathize with what seem to be irreconcilable worldviews. I think one of the hardest things in world conflict, or even conflict between haves and have-nots in a domestic environment like the civil rights movement, is trying to, that, you know, there's cliches about empathy, walk a mile in someone's shoes, but I do think it's important to think about people who differ with us, and even if their ideas might seem retrograde and hateful and hopeless, we want to try to understand, how did they come to have those ideas? Mm-hmm. And again, my father's influenced me a lot. He writes about just growing up Jim Crow. I describe it to students, whether you're black or white, you're living in this environment of segregation, and so many whites just don't question it. It's part of the landscape. Mm-hmm. And so I think thinking about that and then really focusing on people who did start to question it, to me, gives me hope that in a very fractured modern world, we might sort of take historical knowledge and say, if we asked hard questions and hopefully made some progress before, maybe we can move out of this position of cynicism and apathy and things never change, the world's terrible, and some days it feels like it is, but there are moments in history when everyday people have made profound changes. You all mentioned Dr. Melissa Blair, my colleague, and with her study of women and gender studies in American history, just seeing the ways in which women forced a reckoning with their marginalization. And so much of that story is, again, just about average, everyday people calling for attention, refusing to be going on hunger strikes when they're imprisoned for advocating for the right to vote. So that's what I love about studying the past, is thinking maybe someday people will study 2024 or 2025 and say, look at those students and what they did. So to me, it can be inspiring, but it can also be very discouraging.
Yeah, definitely. Lots of good points. Okay, and for our final question, what advice do you have for current and future students of history?
Okay, glass half full. It is a great way. This is, Auburn pays me to say things like this, but I believe in them. It fosters critical thinking, and mm-hmm. I think one of the drawbacks that we have these days, and I say this as a parent with two young people who are in college and one recently out of college, that we focus so much on applied knowledge, which is, again, we need to have people who understand mitochondria and vaccine development, but also the idea of a well-rounded liberal arts education with humanities and sciences, where you just learn to think deeply about a range of issues. And so for me, history doesn't have to be the gateway to a career in history, but it might be a staging for public service or law school or public history. One of the things that's great about Auburn's department is our colleagues are saying, you know, you don't have to become one of us. I mean, that sounds awful, but you could work in a museum and engage with the public in so much of a meaningful way, say at the Equal Justice Initiative Lynching Memorial in Montgomery, or at a battlefield site where you encourage people to see military conflict in a different way. So I feel like history can be a springboard for all kinds of future activities. So I hope over time history will recover. I was speaking with you all about the decline of history mm-hmm. as a major, but these things go in cycles. So I hope someday people tend to like history sometimes. So I hope it comes back.
Me too.
So to end our hour, we want to give some thank yous. So thank you, Dr. Carter, for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you both so much for doing this show.
Thank you to the History Department and our faculty advisor, Dr. Schultz, for their continued support. And of course, thank you to Weagle for their support and their airtime. And a shameless plug, we have another episode this week that's going to be out at 8 a.m. tomorrow. We'll be interviewing Weagle alumni to celebrate Weagle's anniversary, so be sure to tune in. And thank you, dear listeners, for your support. We couldn't do this without you. So we'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to It's All History to Me, the show dedicated to exploring the people, places, and ideas of our past. Be sure to tune in next Thursday at 8 a.m. for more. But for now, keep it here on Weagle 91.1.
See you next time!